Entering Kenmore, doors will open on the left.
How's it going, everybody? Welcome to episode 12 of Entering Kenmore. I am David Azer alongside Zach Coe. Zach, it was an interesting week of baseball for the Boston Red Sox. Started with an embarrassment of a series, to say the least, in Chicago against the White Sox. So we'll start there. As much as we don't want to talk about it, I think there is a decent amount to unpack in this series.
Yeah, the White Sox series was really ugly. It obviously started with a blowout loss, which if you're ever talking about a blowout loss at the hands of the Chicago White Sox, you know something went horribly, horribly wrong. And then, of course, you bring in Chapman in that Saturday game and get walked off. I think it was a leadoff walk to Luis Robert that ended up coming around to score in that one. You salvage the finale as Garrett Crochet almost throws a no-hitter. And even that one was a little closer than you were expecting it to be. I mean, when you're talking about Garrett Crochet throwing a no-hitter, you're like, oh, all right, well, like, you probably won that game like 7-8 to nothing then. No, sure didn't. And it got really hairy there. Whenever you're talking about that close of a series, let alone a series loss to the Chicago White Sox, you know that something went horribly wrong, and that's exactly what happened. But ultimately, it all falls on the offense, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially from going from the home opener with the Cardinals and then just seeing this rut that the offense has been for going on 2 weeks now. We saw it with the Toronto series that we recapped last episode. And then it just kind of spilled over into both of these White Sox and the Rays series that we'll get to later. But yeah, it started with an 11-1 loss in game one. And this was a Sean Newcomb start. So, you know, he's your fifth starter. You'll take what you can get from Sean Newcomb. He ended up giving up only two earned runs. The errors were the story of this game, I feel like. Yeah. I mean, aside from giving up 11 runs to the White Sox, which, like you said, is never going to do it. But this was really a Blake Sabol disaster class. He had two catcher's interference calls that, and then we were talking earlier, he grounded into a double play with the bases loaded, right, at one point in this game. So I'm all set on seeing him for the rest of my life.
About more than enough.
Yeah. That's about all I have to say on him. But the whole offense at this game, they were 1-for-9 with runners in scoring position, which has kind of been the story all season. It seemed like they were turning a bit of a corner in the home opener, you know, converting more with runners on. But it's kind of gone back to the basics with the Red Sox. It seems like this has been a story all season. Something I hope will change, but I haven't seen a lot of evidence to suggest that.
Yeah, but just quickly back to the errors. Casas with two errors in this one, and obviously whenever he does anything, the pitchforks are out for him, and obviously that's been the case all week for Casas and for the fan base. But the strikeouts for the offense, 11 strikeouts against the White Sox pitching, including 6 from Davis Martin, who, if you remember, and our last episode, I was like, this guy doesn't miss any bats. This guy doesn't strike anybody out. His first start against the Tigers was, or I guess that would be his second start. Let me pull up his first start. But that start against the Tigers, it was only 2 strikeouts. His first start against the Angels was only 2 strikeouts. And then his last start, which was yesterday against the Athletics, he only struck out 3 guys. He struck out 6 Red Sox in that start there. So obviously the strikeouts have been alarming, and I saw so many people over the course of the weekend be like, yeah, the Red Sox are striking out a lot, but that's because they have more plate appearances than anyone. They're only middle of the pack in strikeout rate. Well, that's no longer the case, idiots. 25.5% strikeout rate ranks them 4th in Major League Baseball, behind only the Colorado Rockies, Atlanta Braves, and San Francisco Giants. Those are the only teams that are striking out at a higher rate than you. And in terms of sheer number of strikeouts, you are 1st with 197 strikeouts, only with the Colorado Rockies at 195. The next closest team in 3rd is the Giants with 11 fewer strikeouts than you. Jesus. So the strikeouts are a major, major issue.
Yeah, and they have been all year. To go you're 20 games in and you average essentially 10 strikeouts a game. And a lot of those come up in key spots. We've been talking about this since the season started, but more often than not, when they have runners on in scoring position looking to convert, you don't even see productive outs. You just see strikeouts, and that gets nothing done. That gets no runners to advance runners to maybe third or second or whatever. But it's just, it's something has to give. And I am really tired of Pete Fatsy. I don't know if it's his fault, but since he's been here, really, it's been a thing. Like, this is not a new, you know, trend for the Red Sox. We've seen this the last few years, and nothing has really been done about it.
Yeah, and I know I've seen a lot of people be like, well, how much of an impact does the hitting coach really have? Eventually, it's on the players. They have to perform with runners in scoring position. But at a certain point, enough is enough. Like, I know Bradfo said, like, I think Pete Fatsy's a really good hitting coach. And then no disrespect to Bradfo, who I really enjoy, but he had nothing to back that up to be like, oh, he's a really good hitting coach. He just thinks he's a really good hitting coach. End of thought. And I don't doubt that Pete Fatsy's a good hitting coach, but at a certain point, like, something just needs to be shaken up for the sake of shaking things up. You just simply cannot continue to strike out at a 26% rate. You can't strike out 11 more times than the third closest team. Like, I'm not even going to count the Rockies because they're not a major league team. Like, they scored, I know for a fact that they scored zero runs in that weekend series against the Padres last weekend. Jeez. And then that carried over into they only scored three against the Dodgers in that next game. Obviously, their offense kind of came alive in the series finale against Bobby Miller, who sucks. But, like, the Rockies, that's who we're talking about. You struck out two more times than the Colorado Rockies. How is it? And I know the Giants have been good and they're right there with you in terms of strikeout percentage, but it's just they're winning games because they're cashing in with their runners on base or they're finding other ways to score runs. You're not doing that. Not to mention the fact that none of those teams got blown the fuck out by the Chicago White Sox, which I think is, like, honestly, one of the more embarrassing things that could happen, that is going to happen to a team all season, is getting 11 pieced by the Chicago White Sox.
Yeah, it's definitely the low point of the early season so far. Hopefully the low point of the entire year. Because, like I see it, it's only up from here. Like, you can't go from losing a White Sox series. Like, if it gets any worse, then I'm hopping off the radio tower at this point. And
Well, you say that, though, but then you look at that first game of the Rays series, and they get fucking destroyed in that one, too. And I mean, this is obviously jumping ahead, but you come off of losing a series to the Chicago White Sox, and you think, all right, you get a win on Sunday, your ace goes out there, your stopper goes out there and drops his nuts on the table and almost throws a no-hitter. Now we go. No, how about a 16-1 loss where Tanner Houck looks completely fucking lost out there on the mound?
Oh, like, yeah.
It just, every time you feel like, well, not every time because it's only been the one against the White Sox. But again, this is an 11-1 loss to a historically awful baseball team. Like, this is a team that somehow got worse after setting the single season loss record. So I, like, you say it can't get worse from there, and then you think you're going to get some momentum, and immediately you get a 16-1 loss dropped right on your fucking skull too. Like, I'll look it up right now, but their run differential has to be very much in the negative now because of those negative 11 right now.
It's really only from those two games. They gave up 9 to the Cardinals one in the home opener. But aside from that, the pitching has been pretty solid.
Yeah, besides Houck and Newcomb starts here and there, and I think the first two Buehler starts. So, like, it hasn't been the end of the world, but, like, I mean, ultimately you're sitting at 500 right now with a negative 11 run differential. They're the only negative run differential in the American League East. Jeez. And that's even with the blowout win against the Cardinals on Sunday Night Baseball. I know the Cardinals made it a little bit more respectable by the end of it in terms of run differential purposes, 18-7. But you scored 18 runs. You won by, what's that, 9 or no? Jesus Christ, can I do math? You win by 11 and your run differential is still negative 11. Like, how do you have an 11 run win 20 games into the season and still have a negative 11 run differential? I just don't get it. But yeah, I mean, not to harp on the run differential too much, because ultimately it's 20 games into the season.
Yeah, like, but
it is something to keep an eye on.
It's interesting because it seems like it's only a couple guys that you can really blame for it. Like, we've seen Tanner Houck get out there and be lost pretty much all season, like you said. But, I mean, the Ray, game one of the Rays series, which we're jumping around here, but I guess we'll get to it later more in depth. But, yeah, it doesn't set the tone for any Tanner Houck truthers for the rest of the year, if there are any out there. I'm not even really sure. But
how can there be after that last one?
Exactly. And even last year, towards the end of the year, you saw him kind of trailing off, and I don't know if he was overworked or what, or just he never really pitched a full workload, but you kind of expected him to rebound this year, and thus far it hasn't really happened. But yeah, we can I know we kind of touched on game two of this White Sox series, but it was another tough loss. You got carved up by old friend Martin Perez in this game.
Yeah, again, another just embarrassing offensive performance. And I saw people harping on Chapman, and obviously he's an easy punching bag because of his personal off the field stuff, but I mean, he's actually been really good for you down the stretch. Like,
yeah,
obviously eventually he was going to blow a save where a walk came back to bite you in the ass, but again, like, it's hard to really get mad at Chapman when your offense scored two runs on seven hits against, again, the Chicago White Sox and their bullpen and their pitching staff. And Martin Perez was okay in this one. 4 2/3, 5 hits, 2 earned, 5 strikeouts, 4 walks. And then the bullpen of the Chicago White Sox blanked you with Penn Murphy going 1/3 of an inning, getting out of a jam that Martin Perez left him in. BC High legend Mike Vassell goes 2 innings, 1 hit, 3 Ks, 2 strike or 2 walks. I think this guy's name is Jordan Leisure. Yeah. Yeah, Jordan Leisure, whoever that is, comes in 1 2/3, 2 strikeouts, 1 hit, and then Tyler Gilbert comes in for the last out there, gets it. Like, ultimately, you just need to be doing more on offense against the Chicago White Sox. Martin Perez has been having a good year, but, like, who are these idiots aside from BC High legend Mike Vassell in the White Sox bullpen? Like, I just don't understand how you can only put up 2 runs on 7 hits. And you want to say that, oh, it's the runners in scoring position thing too, but they only had 6 at-bats with runners in scoring position in this entire game. So they went 1 for 6, and they scored 2 runs in the 5th inning and didn't score for the other eight innings. So, again, like, I understand that Chapman's the easy punching bag and it was a walk that ends up biting you. But, like, ultimately, if you're walking Luis Robert and taking your chances with the rest of this White Sox lineup, I'm okay with that. It just so happened that big Joshua Palacios, or no, not Palacios, Brooks Baldwin, who pinch hit for Palacios, gets the job done for them. It's like, all right, we need to be able to get out Brooks Baldwin, but it's hard, like I said, it's hard to blame him when the offense has just been completely inept. And even in this one, they limited the, or I guess they didn't limit the strikeouts. I was looking at walks with 6. They had 6 walks, scored 2 runs. How do you walk 6 times and only score 2 runs? You strike out 11 times. I don't understand. And I'll pull up the numbers right now, because now that I'm looking at it, that's ridiculous. Between the 3 games in Chicago, you struck out, let's see, you struck out 22 times in the first 2 games. And then you struck out, so you struck out 29 times to the Chicago White Sox pitching staff.
Jeez. Yeah, that is just embarrassing. I think, and also a key part of this game was Richard Fitz left in the 5th inning or in the 6th inning. It was like a shoulder pectoral injury. So yeah, he's on the shelf for, I think, 15 days at least. And the Red Sox were winning, and he was dealing heading into this game. So they were up 2, heading into the 6th inning. And then I think he maybe faced one batter, or it was like a full count. Once Zach Kelly came into the game after Fitz had to leave, and then Zach Kelly promptly blew the game. Which I can't get too mad at him for, just because you're coming in and you're not really prepared. He didn't have any sort of warm up in the bullpen before he was just thrust into the game, and obviously had his warm up pitches. But even still, I can't imagine how warm you are coming in when you're not expecting it at all.
Yeah, you're not. You go from not throwing at all to having to ramp up. And I know technically that you get however much time you need, but you're out there on the mound and you're trying to get loose, and you have as much time as you need. But everyone else is just standing around.
Right.
All the fans are staring out at you on the mound. Like I have to imagine that you're sitting there going, like, "All right, I'm good. I'm fine. Like I'm good
enough."
Like, you're definitely not as warm as you would be if you got your full build up in the bullpen. So, it's hard to blame anyone on the pitching staff for allowing three runs in a baseball game against the Chicago White Sox. Like, obviously, the White Sox are not a good offense, but three runs should be enough to win you a baseball game, or hold an offense to three runs. Like, ultimately, struck out 11 times and scored twice against the Chicago White Sox. And I know I keep saying that, but it's the Chicago White Sox and their pitching staff of a bunch of guys that you've never heard of before. And they're striking you out 29 times over a 3-game series. Like, I mean, I know they won the finale, but I would have rather they got swept. Like, I feel exactly the same coming out of that series as if they got swept.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good point, because even in this game 3 victory, where you needed 7 2/3 essentially of no hit ball from from Garrett Crochet, you still don't feel great about this win. Like, Garrett Crochet cannot be the stopper every single time he has to pitch. You can't be going, like, you can't come into this game 0-2 against the White Sox and being like, "Oh, well, Garrett Crochet, we really need a win from you. I know we just paid you a boatload of money and you're the ace of our staff, but you got to get wins from other places. You can't just expect Garrett Crochet to solve all your problems every time he goes out there." Because we saw in the Toronto series that, I mean, granted, it was really fucking cold out, and I was at that game freezing my ass off, and he didn't look right because it was 30 degrees out. So you can't really get on him for that. But even in his worst starts, Garrett Crochet is putting you in a position to win pretty much all of his starts I've seen so far. And you just need someone else in this rotation to lean on. And we've seen it. We've seen Walker Buehler kind of turn a corner. We've seen Sean Newcomb give you some quality innings. Tanner Houck is a big question mark, and you're going to need him to produce. Even when Brian Baio and Lucas Giolito come back, they're coming back from injuries, especially Lucas Giolito, who hasn't pitched in going on 2 years now. So you can't rely on him. I don't exactly know what to expect from Brian Baio either, because he's still ramping up, and even in his rehab starts, he hasn't looked super sharp. I know the velo's up a bit, but aside from that, he's been giving up runs left and right to double and triple A players. So we'll see how that
swings and misses. The whiffs are way up. I don't really give a shit about the runs. If the whiffs are way, like, if I think he struck out 7 guys in his last outing in Portland, which you can say, yeah, whatever, it's double A batters, but I don't know if the swing and miss is going to be up, I think he'll be able to have success. And a lot of times, guys, especially at this point in the season, are treating these rehab starts like their spring training appearances. So he could be tinkering with any number of different things that the staff wanted him to do, and he's kind of treating that as a spring training. So I'm not all that concerned about the runs or the contact. Obviously, we don't have the hard hit metrics or any of that stuff coming from rehab starts, but I don't know. I'm not super concerned about that. But even just going back to that third game, I mean, Crochet, he gets Michael Taylor to pop up for the first out in the 8th inning. Chase Meidroth singles on kind of a weirdly, like, I don't want to say it was weakly hit necessarily, because it was still hit at 91.5 miles an hour, but it was kind of just put in the perfect spot. I thought Story maybe could have had a play on it. I initially said you have to make that play if you're Trevor Story. I've since walked that back in saying that it's a play that could be made, but who knows with Meidroth getting down the bases. I don't know what he is like for speed. Based on looking at him, I would guess he's middle of the pack in terms of speed. But then Garrett Whitlock comes in, and Cora said after the game it was going to be a real, like, internal battle on whether or not they were going to let Crochet try to finish it, because his pitch count was getting up there. He ended up getting pulled with
96, I think.
Yes. 96. So 96 through 8 1/3 or 7 and a third, excuse me. So he would have probably been, he would have been over, well over 100 heading into that ninth inning. So it would have been interesting. I'm always of the belief, especially that late into a game, that you let him go until he gives up a hit. So I hope he would have done that in that scenario. But the larger point is you put in Whitlock and he immediately starts to blow the lead.
Yeah, yeah. Not a great day for the Whitlock heads, I will say.
Yeah.
Brooks also Ball, an interesting spot for him.
Yeah, but it's one against the Chicago White Sox where, like, this is your bullpen ace, supposedly, that you're looking for. Like, he needs to come in and shut this down. You need him to get two outs against Brooks Baldwin, Matt Theiss, Josh Palacios, and Miguel Vargas. And that's who he ended up facing. But Brooks Baldwin singles, Matt Theiss singles. All of a sudden, it's a 2-1 ball game in a game where your starting pitcher just threw 7 1/3 no-hit innings. It's just – and I know I said that it's ultimately on the offense to get going, and you need to be scoring more than two runs when you're – starting pitcher as a no-hitter through seven innings. And ultimately, they do get that insurance from Trevor Story, but just a little bit shakier of a appearance out of Whitlock than we were hoping for. And then, obviously, Chapman comes in and shuts it down in the ninth to lock up a 3-2 win after Story gets you some insurance.
Yeah, there was a 3-1 win. But the other thing of this is I think the Trevor Story home run was – the Red Sox first home run for like a week.
A week. Yeah. It was the first home run since the Sunday night baseball game against.
Yeah. Which not going to get it done. And I know we keep saying it was cold in the Toronto series, but you're getting little to no home runs against the Chicago White Sox all series until when was this? This was the top of the ninth of game three in the Chicago series. Yeah. So
George Springer fucking shit on a ball in the same weather that you couldn't get the ball out in. So, like, I don't know. Like, I understand it was cold, but at a certain point, the offense needs to produce. And
exactly.
Like we said, they've been striking out at a ridiculous pace.
Yeah. So, at this point, it seems like it's been – I mean, that kind of changed in the Tampa Bay series. But for a while here, it kind of seemed like it was home run or strikeout and little to nothing else, either a walk and then a couple strikeouts to not convert with runners in scoring position. In this game, they were 2-for-5 with runners in scoring position. I think in game two, they were 1-for-6. So still overall, the converting with runners in scoring position has just been brutal all season. I didn't look at the numbers in the Tampa Bay series yet. I'm sure we'll unpack them as we get to it, but it wasn't great there either.
Well, just from a strikeout perspective, I'm looking at it now since that Cardinals series, they've struck out 101 times in 10 games. So you're averaging 10 strikeouts a game, hitting only 212. You've hit 6 home runs, which even like how many of those home runs do you want to count in that little league ballpark that they're playing in down in Tampa? And you scored 23 runs. So you're averaging 2.3 runs per game since that Cardinals series, striking out, like I said, 101 times. Let's see what the rate looks like on that. That will be a 27.4% strikeout rate. That's third best in that 10-game stretch. And all those other teams have only played 9 games. So their percentages are going to be a little bit higher because it's a smaller sample. But that's the Rockies, who struck out in 9 games at a 30.5% clip. The Tigers striking out at a 27.6% clip. And then you at 27.4. So like ultimately it all boils down to strikeouts. And it's not just that they're striking out. It's largely non-competitive at-bats.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you saw in – I think it was game two of the White Sox series where they brought in Tyler Gilbert to face Rafael Devers for the last out of that game. And no, it couldn't have been game two. It must have been game.
No, game two, lost... Tyler Gilbert did come in.
Okay. So it was the top of the ninth. Where...
He was the one.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So you were tied heading into the bottom of the ninth and they bring in Tyler Gilbert in the top of the ninth and Rafael Devers had a 2-pitch. Maybe the most non-competitive at bat I've seen from him in a while. I mean, since he was going whatever he was to start the year. I mean, 0-for-21 or whatever it was. So you've kind of seen Devers cool off, and basically a majority of the lineup has cooled off besides Trevor Story. I mean, we were texting about this. I don't remember exactly what I said, but something along the lines of, I know you don't like Trevor Story, but he's the only one producing consistently right now. And that kind of tailed off a bit in the Tampa series, but overall, this lineup just has to wake up. And yeah, I'm a little bit worried about it, not gonna lie.
Yeah, we might as well have this conversation now since we're talking about the offensive struggles. Yeah. But where are you at on Tristan Casas?
Okay, so I'm never fully out on Tristan Casas. I think you saw him kind of turn a corner in this Tampa series. The hits didn't come together, but you saw the hard hit balls more often than he's been doing all season. And what other options do you have at this point?
Well, you don't. Like,
Exactly. Like, to the point where Tristan Casas is struggling so much, and I hear people, casuals, mind you, saying, oh, let's call up Roman Anthony and make him a first baseman. Like, please just shut the fuck up. Like, that is the easiest way to tell me that you don't watch baseball.
I don't even think that these people understand, like, what they're saying and, like, oh, like, let's just teach Roman Anthony first base. If you were to teach Roman Anthony first base, that would not expedite his arrival to the majors.
Not at all.
Even slightly. It would delay him very significantly to have to teach him first base. Because how many times has he played first base in his life? I would venture to guess
probably not very zero. Much.
I mean, we're talking about a guy who at every single level from the second he picked up a baseball bat was the best player on the field. Like, this is a guy who is insanely talented. This is a kid who, growing up, was playing shortstop, center field, and pitching. He was not playing first base. So, it's a guy who is starting at complete zero in terms of first base. And could he learn the position? Sure. I'm sure he could learn the position because it's not very hard. I mean, Kyle Schwarber learned to play the position. And people I saw were saying, like, oh, well, yeah, sort of. But he was serviceable enough. But, like, Bryce Harper made the transition from outfield to first base. He was well into his major league career and recovering from Tommy John surgery. He was learning first base so they could get his bat back in the lineup. I don't think they ever expected to keep him at first base in that scenario. It just so happens that he was good at it, so they kept him there. Like, I don't think we're looking at a Bryce Harper situation, let alone because Harper's 10 years older than Roman Anthony is trying to make this transition. But I agree with what you said there. Like, just tell me you don't watch the sport. Tell me you have a fundamental misunderstanding of the sport of baseball. And I know they're getting Vaughn Grissom reps at first base. They're also getting him reps at third base, trying to increase his versatility. So eventually I think maybe you see him up here. I know Romy's an absolute butcher at first base. He's been swinging a good bat right now, but I don't think that's a long-term solution at first. Like, ultimately your solution at first base is Tristan Casas has got to start hitting the ball, and he's got to start being better. And I dove into the numbers a little bit deeper because I was kind of interested to see where he was at, because it felt like he was making a lot of hard contact and it just wasn't falling in. He was actually making less hard contact than I was expecting. He's only 39th percentile in hard hit percentage, 39.1 on the hard hit rate. He is barreling up a lot of balls at 66th percentile, 10.9%. And the launch angle sweet spot is 81st percentile, 41.3%. I understand that those are nerd stats, and ultimately people don't really give a shit about the nerd stats because the results on the field. And I know people, casuals will sit there and say, like, you'll give Tristan Casas's career numbers, be like, oh yeah, well, he's a 122 career OPS plus, he's a 22% above league average bat, he's shown the ability to have 40 home run power, not expand the strike zone, walk at a elite rate. You haven't seen either of those things this year. It's a 25.7% K rate, which is 32nd percentile, and only a 7.1% walk rate, which is a 36th percentile there. But everyone's, well, I go by the eye test. Well, listen up, you fucking morons. These numbers that we're giving you, the OPS plus and the strikeout rate and the walk rate over his career, are what your eyes are seeing. Like, these are, that's an exit. Like, it's, they're not, these numbers aren't just pulled out of people's asses. You can't just sit there and be like, well, I go by the eye test, the eye test told me that this guy fucking sucks. No, the eye test tells you that his fingernails are navy blue, so you don't like him because you're a fucking homophobe. Like, that's what it tells you. And everyone, Rick, callers all week were saying that's not Tristan Casas is not gay. Like, I don't know if anybody follows him on Instagram, but when girls post on their Instagram stories and just simply tag him in the stories, he reposts every single one of them. Like, he might be the thirstiest guy on the Boston Red Sox solely based on his Instagram interactions. Like, if I didn't get to the episode yet, but there was a part in the trailer where Casas was sitting in the on deck circle looking around the crowd going, oh yeah, all the baddies are here, all the baddies are here to see you. Like, and everybody says all week, callers have said on radio stations across the board, I don't care about the off the field stuff, I care about this. And then they'll go on there's big whole long rant about why they don't like Tristan Casas, and then it always circles back to, and he paints his nails, or and he sits there and he does yoga in the outfield. So it's not just what he does on the field. You don't like him because you think that he's gay, or you think that he doesn't live up to the stereotypical masculinity bullshit that you set for yourself. And ultimately, none of that bullshit matters if he paints his nails and he starts to produce, but he hasn't produced yet. And that's the issue. And this was a long-winded rant to go back to say that I think he's getting a little bit unlucky. Like, some of the at-bats, I think he's being a little too passive. I start to wonder if maybe he's focusing too much on what they wanted him to work on in the offseason and spring of trying to drive the ball to the opposite field. So he's getting a little bit in between pitches. So instead of swinging what he normally would, he's like, all right, let me try and use the opposite field. So then he tries to delay himself half a second to, and then he ends up being way later. But it's only a 222 BABIP this year, which, if you don't know what that means, it's batting average on balls in play. League average is 300. So they say on balls that you make contact on, about 30% of the time, it should be a base hit. It's only 222 for Casas in this one. Just for reference, last year it was a 311, and the year before it was a 317. And just to put into perspective some of the other stats there, his walk percentage last year was a 12.3. Year before that, it was a 13.9. And if you do want to go all the way back to 2022, where it was a really small 27-game sample size, it was a 20% K rate or walk rate. Last year, the K rate was, granted, inflated, 31.7% K rate, which is unacceptable for him, but before that it was a 25.1% K rate. So I think he's getting a little bit unlucky. I mean, last year, 311 BABIP, a 241 batting average. Year before, 317 BABIP, 263 batting average. These things are going to level themselves out. Like, water finds its level. That's what's good about having a 162 game season, is that eventually things, there's going to be overcorrection. So, like, at some point, Casas is going to get so scorching hot that every ball that he puts in play is going to fall. Just the same way right now that only 22% of the balls that he puts in play are falling in for hits. So, like, ultimately, it's a shitty start, and I think he's obviously not been good. I mean, just looking at his offensive efficiency, it's a negative 5.2. on Fangraphs. He's killing you. It's a negative 2.8 on defense, good for a negative 0.6 F4. So, like, it's not to say that he hasn't been awful, because he has been awful, but it is to say, take a breath, because this is a guy that I still believe in. And at this point, I've hitched my wagons to Tristan Casas. I'll be the very last guy on the Titanic saying, just wait, just wait. But ultimately, where he's played 18 games in this season, only one home run, three RBIs. But I think there are metrics that point to him getting better. And ultimately, he's been a slow starter at every level of the minors since he's been drafted by the organization. It's just, how long can you wait for him to keep going? I mean, obviously, we saw him sit in the cleanup spot for the first 2 weeks of the season. Now he's been moved down to the sixth hole, and the results still haven't come. So, but he's at least not killing you there in the heart of your order. And again, like I said, eventually water's going to find its level. That BABIP is not going to sit at 220 for the entire season. If it does, you'll catch me in September saying, well, the BABIP was only 220 this year. So, like, we can't really even say that he was that bad. And I'm fine to admit that, but I'm also willing to say that he's played 18 games this year. Like, let's let this play out a little bit before we immediately jump to all these conclusions that he sucks. We need to teach Roman Anthony first base. We need to DFA him, which, like, he still has options. So, like, DFAing him is not even remotely on the table. Like, they would send him to AAA far before he would ever get DFA'd. Let's just get rid of him for what you can. I don't know if you fucking morons know this, but Craig Breslow neglected figuring out this outfield jam solely because he was trying to get Tristan Casas the fuck off this baseball team for whatever reason. And what the solution would have been if he was able to accomplish that beats me, beats the shit out of me. But we're sitting here arguing about where Roman Anthony's going to play because we sat on our hands for the entire offseason and didn't figure out this outfield nonsense. We have to watch Sidon Rafaela get up there and pop out every at bat because we didn't figure out this outfield
logic. Oh, boy.
And while Roman Anthony hits grand slam after grand slam in AAA because he needs to get ready to face lefties that Cora is going to bench him against.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Like, I don't know. That was a long-winded rant, but I'm not there yet on pressing the panic button on Tristan Casas. The panic button is firmly uncovered, but once you take a closer look under the hood, I just think that he's too talented of a hitter not to figure this out and not to come out of it, at least somewhere on the positive side.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to let you cook with that. Couldn't have said it better myself. I do have a couple things to add real quick. One is we saw the same reaction from fans with Rafael Devers when he started the season 0-21, and he figured it out. So it's 20 games in. I think Casas is going to be just fine. And I also go back to the clubhouse documentary. I'm four episodes in now, and we saw Alex Cora. There was kind of a whole deep dive on Casas's personality. And Alex Cora said, like you said, Zach, that no one's going to care about his off-field antics or, you know, quirks if he's producing. So it all comes to the spotlight right now because he's not producing. And I'm not worried about Casas at all, to be honest. I think as you head into later in the season, if he's still not producing, then it becomes more of a question mark. But it's April. We're halfway through April. And I think just give him the time to figure it out. One, because you don't have other options. And two, because you've already committed a lot to Casas being your first baseman of the future. Whether or not people want to admit that, they don't have a backup plan right now. So you don't really have a choice. You have to see this through. And I'm kind of just sick and tired of people shitting on him because the rest of the lineup hasn't produced for a lot of the season as well. So the other guy who's come into question with Tristan Casas' struggles, because a lot of casuals want to be like, oh, let's teach Roman Anthony first base. He's been tearing up the minors right now. Maybe that was bad phrasing. But he's been tearing up the minor leagues. And so here are his stats, his surface level stats, granted. But he's hitting .283 right now. He has four home runs, 12 RBIs. He's walked 14 times. He has struck out 17 times, but, you know, I'm not too worried about that, especially if the rest of the team is also striking out at a super high rate. But overall, Roman Anthony's kind of forcing your hand. And we talked about how Craig Breslow didn't really address the outfield logjam at all because, like Zach said, he was trying his damn best to get Tristan Casas the hell out of here. But now Roman Anthony's knocking down the door to the major leagues. And like we said, I think we both kind of predicted around this time Roman Anthony would be on the rise and getting into the major leagues at this point. And it seems like the writing's kind of on the wall for how long he's going to remain in AAA.
Yeah. And just to a little bit more under the hood stats, this comes from TJ Stats on Twitter, who does the minor league slider charts, similar to what you see on Baseball Savant. He's got a barrel percentage up to 38.9% after two home runs yesterday. He is 100th percentile in average exit velo, 97th percentile in 90th percentage exit velo. His max exit velo is 96th percentile. Obviously, the barrel rate is 100th percentile. Hard hit percentage is 98th percentile, 67.7%, which is just absolutely ridiculous. The launch angle sweet spot is 97th percentile. The walk rate is 97th percentile. On the flip side, he is still striking out at a 25.4% clip, which if he's hitting the ball that hard, I personally don't give a fuck about if a guy's walking or striking out 25% of the time, but also walking 22% of the time. and his whiff percentage is 34.6%. So obviously not a perfect profile to start, but like ultimately when you're talking about a guy that hits the ball as hard as he does, it just raises the ceiling so, and the floor, it just raises the caliber of player he is so much that you can kind of live with those things. And ultimately I think I was okay with making him force your hand by sending him down to start the season. But like now your hand is firmly being forced, and it's kind of comes at a shitty time because a week ago yesterday was the deadline to call up guys and still be eligible for the prospect promotion incentive pick if they win rookie of the year. And I think at this point, if you were to call up Roman Anthony today, he's probably the odds-on favorite to win rookie of the year. So you fuck yourself by getting service time or losing a year of service time, and you don't get the pick. So I would be surprised if they didn't wait it out like another week or two, just so they don't look like complete fucking morons for not calling him up before that deadline. But ultimately, this is what has pissed me off about some of the narrative about Roman Anthony. You're the Boston Red Sox. You're not the Pittsburgh Pirates, who fucked around with Paul Skeens and lost a year of service time. Even the Braves did it with Michael Harris the first year that this was a thing. They lost a year of service time. You're the Boston Red Sox. If Roman Anthony is the caliber of player that you and I and everyone else thinks he's going to be, this is a guy that you're going to want to lock up anyways. So I don't understand the point of bitching and moaning about, oh, we need that extra year of service time so he's under team control. Like, I understand the value of service time, but ultimately you can't sit there and say, and we didn't even talk about this in terms of the White Sox series, but Cora, or maybe he was even in the first Rays game, but Cora got asked a question by Pete Abe. It was like, in spring training, you said you guys were ready to win now. You just got blown the fuck out. Like, thoughts? Like, and Cora said, like, what do you mean? It's been a tough start. Like, we are ready to win now. Just like getting blown out one game doesn't mean that we're not ready to win. You can't say that you're ready to win and you're a team that's looking to compete when I think there's a chance that Roman Anthony might be the best player in the organization, period, at any level. Like, so a guy with that kind of caliber is just sitting in AAA. Like, you can't say, oh, we're ready to win when we're not putting out our best lineup night in and night out. Like, can you honestly sit here and say, like, your best lineup doesn't include Roman Anthony on at least a mostly regular basis? I don't think you can. And all that to say, like I said, I don't think they're going to call him up anytime soon, or at least not within the next week or two because of that prospect pick. But like I said, this is a guy that you should be paying anyways. So like if you pay him in what it'd be 6 years, you could lose a year. So you're talking about either paying him in 2029 or 2030. Or 2031 or 2030. Like, this is a guy that you should be paying big money anyways. And I've seen people be like, oh, well, we can't just assume that they're going to pay Roman Anthony because if he hits the open market, then who knows what he's going to get. And they didn't pay Mookie. Roman Anthony's going to be hitting the open market. He's 20 years old right now. So in 6 years, he's going to be 26. Mookie was hitting the open market at 30. And if there's anything that we've seen about this new iteration and this new thought process of the Fenway Sports Group, it's that we know that they're going to target guys right in that age range to extend or go after. Obviously, this dates back to Heim saying that Devers is obviously a guy that we want to keep here because he's going to be hitting the open market at 26. We saw them pursue Juan Soto, who hit the open market at what, he's 25, 26, right in that.
Yeah.
Either way, right in that age range. Everyone just assumed that they were going to be going after Vladdy, who also was right in that age range. So these are guys that if they're, and again, we're talking about 5-6 years down the road. So who knows what their mentality could be. I mean, shit, we saw them say that they weren't going to sign pitchers over 30 in what year would it have been? 2015, when John Lester was a free agent. And then in 2017, completely turn around and change their mind there and give the largest contract ever for a left-handed pitcher to David Price. We saw them empty the bank to go all in for that 2018 World Series. And 2 years later, say, we're not going to do business like that anymore. So their attitudes about team building go as the wind goes. So that this philosophy could completely change in 6 years. But Roman Anthony's not a guy that they're going to look at like they would Mookie. And Mookie, thoughts on the Mookie trade aside, I'm not going to rehash it because it was 5 years ago. And frankly, I'm sick of the discourse about it. But, yep. But this is a guy that is right, going to be right in that age range of someone that you should be extending anyways. So I don't understand the fuss about like, oh, well, they traded Mookie, they didn't pay Mookie. Like, this is an apples to oranges situation. And by the time Roman Anthony hits free agency, if he ever does, because again, we don't even know if he's going to or not, we're going to be talking about 10 years since the Mookie trade. And I refuse to be arguing about something and using that as an example when it was literally a decade ago, which is like wild to think about that we're already 5 years removed from the Mookie trade.
Yeah, like you said, I'm tired of hearing about it, and I don't think it's an exact comparison at all. And another thing I've been hearing about the whole Roman Anthony discourse is, where is he going to play? I think it's the easiest solution in the world, and people are just so banging their head against a wall to try to create some conversation about it, because it is the most simple solution ever. I think you should put Roman Anthony in left field. I don't like Duran in left field. He's been struggling over there. And he has been for a while. He's just not great at reading the monster. I know Cora said that was one of his strengths. I don't see it personally, and I think he's gotten a hell of a lot better in center field. So why not just keep him there when he has way more speed than Roman Anthony as well? And just give Anthony a lot less ground to cover. But all that to say, just take Rafaela out of center field, okay? I'm tired of hearing the argument that his glove allows him to swing a wet noodle at the plate. I'm tired of seeing it. And I know that I was kind of sticking up for Rafaela as we headed into this season. I know he was your pick for biggest disappointment this year. And he's been nothing but a disappointment offensively. Defensively, you know what you're going to get with him. You're going to get an elite level defender. Could win a platinum glove if he's out there every day. But I don't care. I don't need a Jackie Bradley Jr. in this lineup. You want to put the best lineup out there, like you said. And your best lineup does not have Sedan Rafaela anywhere near it. And Oh, what's up?
No, go ahead. Finish your thought.
So if you're valuing his defense, then isn't he a perfect super utility guy? I know I've been beating this drum for a while, but if you're just valuing him on defense, then I would argue he is way more useful to your team if he can give a lot of people a day off and he can still be virtually an everyday player just in different positions to keep the rest of your lineup fresh. Like, that is a perfect world. I think the Red Sox benefited a lot from Brock Holt in 2018, and he will always be a trivia question to me because he was the first person ever, I think still the first person, to hit a cycle in the playoffs, which is just a fun fact I always like bringing up whenever Brock Holt is in a discussion. But all this to say, you need a Brock Holt on a World Series winning roster, and Sedan Rafaela can be that guy. I don't know why we're vouching for him to be an everyday player when he has shown nothing to prove that.
Yeah, and it's one of those things, too, where like the big thing last year was the strikeout rate and the chase was way too high. He's cut down on the strikeout rate, but the chase is still 47.7%. So he still hasn't shown the ability to lay off balls outside of the strike zone, but also the decrease in K percentage. I mean, he's only to 19.4% K rate this year compared to a 26.4 last year, but it isn't translating to results. He's still not hitting the ball hard. It's 16th percentile average exit velo. He's not barreling the ball up. He's not, like I said, the hard hit percentage is also down. He's not getting sweet spot. He's not squaring the ball up. It's not turning into results the way that people kind of took for granted that it would. And I don't even think it's like get him out of the lineup, because if we know anything about Alex Cora, it's that he is going to play the platoons with rookies. So Roman Anthony is not going to see left-handed hitters. Like, I think I talked about this on the last episode, but Craig Breslow did an interview with Chris Cotillo where he said, we're still looking for Roman to face left-handed pitching. He hasn't been exposed to a ton of left-handed pitching in AAA. This, like, why? it doesn't matter. He's not going to face left-handed pitching. And if he does, it's going to be such a small sample size that it's going to be nothing to glean from. I agree with you that I'd like to see Roman Anthony in left when they do call him up. It seems like he's going to be the center fielder when he gets called up for whatever reason. It just seems like, I mean, fuck, they're willing to put Christian Campbell in center field over moving Duran to out of left. That it's mostly familiarity for Christian Campbell and playing center, but to me that doesn't really matter because I don't, like I said on the last episode, I just don't think he should be playing the outfield at all if we're claiming that he's a work in progress defensively at second base. But so for me, I agree. I think it's the easiest solution of all time, and everyone's just kind of killing themselves over trying to trade one of Abreu or Rafaela or Duran. And it's really not all that necessary because it should be Anthony in left, Duran in center when you're facing a righty, and Duran in left and Rafaela in center when you're facing a lefty. And it's that simple. And I think that's exactly what they're going to do. And maybe they put Anthony in center and leave Duran in left for the sake of consistency for Duran. But it's quite literally that simple. And I would be absolutely floored if they did anything other than that when Anthony does eventually get called up. Like, I don't see Cora breaking the trend of letting him face lefties magically because he hasn't done that with literally anybody. And granted, I know that none of those other prospects have been number one prospect in the sport level guys, but Tristan Casas was a top 30 prospect when he was on his way up. Like, they've had guys that have had pretty prominent prospect status come through, and he's held true to that. Like, you're not facing lefties. I mean, he did it all the way going back to Rafael Devers as a rookie. Eduardo Nunez was the platoon for Rafael Devers. So, like, I just can't imagine that that's going to break at all. So it just feels like the easiest solution ever. And for whatever reason, we're not acknowledging that as the reality.
Exactly. That's what pisses me off the most, because it seems like such an easy fix to you and I who watch every single game and do all this research. But for the casual fan who's just like, oh, well, yeah, let's get Casas out of here and make him a first baseman. Yeah. You think that can just magically happen overnight is astounding to me. And there are many ways to still implement Anthony as an everyday player. But yeah, another question mark, and this transitions well into our Rays series recap, is Tanner Houck, because he got absolutely blown up in game one of this series. Let me get the line real quick. It is bad. Okay. So he pitched 2 1/3. 10 hits, 12 runs, only 11 of them earned, so I'll give him that. Walked 2, struck out 1, 2 home runs. He's sporting a 9.16 ERA, and I believe this is 4 starts into the year, maybe 3?
4? I want to say
I think it's 4. But yeah, so this is a big concern, and I think it might be time to hit the panic button on Tanner Houck. And I don't want to toot my own horn. I know I picked him as my biggest disappointment of the year heading into the season. Granted, that was just because I saw nothing from him to prove otherwise in spring training. And he really has, this is kind of just an extended spring training for him at this point. This has been rough from a guy who, granted, you don't have to rely on as much now that you have Garrett Crochet as your ace. That's fine. But you do need a solid number two and rest of your rotation. Tanner Houck was slated to be that guy. Early returns are horrible, just absolutely horrible. The swing and miss has been down across the board in every single start. There are no positives to take away from Tanner Houck starts this year. Even I think he had a decent outing versus the Blue Jays last time out before this. But even still, yeah. I'm just very worried about him as a whole.
Yeah, I mean, the big thing, it goes back to spring training. He's just not missing bats at the level he needs to. I mean, if you pull up the Savant page, it is a whole lot of blue. Like I said, not missing any bats, only 21% whiff percentage, 9th percentile, K percentage 12.6. The hard hit rate is 7th percentile, 54% of balls hit in play are hit hard. He is getting the ball hit on the ground a decent bit. But again, like I said, it's getting hit hard every time it gets hit. So it doesn't matter if it's on the ground. Like technically, seeing eye singles right up the middle hit at 110 miles an hour count towards your ground ball rate.
Right.
And I'm right there with you. I think that my hand is firmly pressed down on the panic button on Tanner Houck. Aside from that one start against Toronto, it just hasn't been the same. And I know that Red Sox Stats tweeted this that I'm trying to find the exact tweet now, but he essentially was like, the movement just isn't the same. And here it is. Instead of a cutter and a nasty sweeper, it's now one pitch in the middle that is trash. So yeah. The cutter and the sweeper are not getting the same type of break, which means it's hanging out over the zone more. And obviously it's just getting absolutely fucking crushed. And in this first game against Tampa, that was a prime example of that. Like you said, 11 earned runs, which like I won't give him credit for 11 earned runs and giving up 12, because that is a fucking
sarcastic. Yeah.
That is a dog shit line, and he has been complete and utter dog shit to start the year. And we started to see signs of it in the second half of last year as time wore on. And I think me, you, and a whole lot of other people just wrote it off as, oh, well, he hasn't pitched a full season yet, so this is just him getting used to an increased level of workload.
Right.
And I think maybe that was just explaining away some issues that we saw and are now seeing crop up again here at the start of this year. And I think ultimately it goes back to something that we were talking about in our spring training episodes when we were beating the drum for a Dylan Cease or a Michael King trade, just that it felt like you needed like one more sure thing arm, because you obviously you had Houck and you were kind of banking on him repeating the success of last year and being an all-star type guy. But then after him, you were looking for a rebound year from Brian Baio. You were looking to see what Walker Buehler still had in the tank after a choppy regular season and a great playoffs. Giolito hasn't pitched in 2 years, and the last time he pitched, it was terrible. And I know that he had a lot of off-the-field things going on there, so I guess we'll see what happens when he comes back. Cutter Crawford, who I don't think anybody should on Cutter Crawford more than the two of us in the offseason. And obviously he hasn't been healthy since the start of the season. I haven't seen an update on him in ages, so it doesn't feel like he's anywhere close. Obviously, then you get into more of the depth. Richard Fitz, who is now injured. Quinn Priester, who is now a Milwaukee Brewer. Hunter Dobbins, who's kind of emerged. But we did this last year, and I don't think we've gone as far as quick as we did last year with the pitching depth, saying like, oh, we got pitching depth, we should be good, to like, oh shit, where the fuck did all this pitching depth go? But I think we're getting close to that, where it's like we thought we had all the pitching depth in the world, and now it's just not there. And it just feels like you're one solid number two away from having a really solid rotation, or not even solid, from having the best rotation in baseball. And now you're sitting here. I mean, obviously a lot can change between now and the trade deadline. The Padres are the best team in baseball right now by record, I believe. So they're not trading either of those guys, King or Cease, even if they're just willing to let them walk in the offseason. Let me look. Yeah, the Padres at 15-4 are the best team in baseball currently. So those guys aren't going anywhere anytime soon. Sandy Alcantara was another name that was thrown around a lot in the offseason. I believe it was Ken Rosenthal had a report that he might not get traded as soon as everybody thinks he's going to. So, and obviously, like I said, a lot can change between now and July 31st or whenever the trade deadline is right around that area. But it just feels like you're going to need to be in the market for another top of the line starting pitcher, which are obviously the most expensive pieces to get. And like, when you start to look at the prospect pool, what else do you really have? Because to me, Meyer and Anthony should be and are completely untouchable. So those two are non-starters. You already dipped into the Kyle Teal, Brandon Montgomery's of the world. How do you want to address the outfield logjam? It feels like something that should be addressed in the offseason, because what is trading a Willy or Abreu for a starter due to the clubhouse dynamic? I can't imagine it would be great, let alone doing that for Jarren Duran. And like, that's the caliber of player that you're talking about giving up for one of these guys. So like, what does that look like in terms of pissing off the clubhouse? I mean, we saw a bad team in 2021 traded Christian Vasquez, and Xander Bogaerts was like ready to cry talking to the media. So let alone like talk about a guy that has an actual impact on the field, not just in the clubhouse. It feels like they're an arm short. And all granted, like I said, things can change with other teams. Things can change with the Red Sox. Maybe Walker Buehler has actually turned a corner and he's going to be that second guy. Maybe Brian Bayo, the whiff rate and the swing and miss is going to translate incredibly from the rehab starts getting back into major league games. It's too early to tell, but it just feels like they were one move short. And that move was clearing out the outfield logjam, having Roman Anthony on your opening day roster and having Michael King or Dylan Cease back right behind Garrett Crochet as the nastiest 1-2 punch in baseball.
Yeah, and I think there's still an avenue to get there, but it probably won't be this year, like you said. So the game one of the Rays series, they lost 16-1. We touched on Tanner Houck, but the only other thing that I really took away from this game was Christian Campbell hit his third home run of the season. That was cool. He's definitely tailed off a little bit in terms of production, but even still, he's been one of your most productive hitters. I think he had is either a 17 or 18 game on base streak to start his career. So obviously all good things from Christian Campbell there. So game two was really the Alex Bregman game. The Red Sox won 7-4, and this seemed like the offense was starting to turn a corner, but then we'll get to game three. And obviously that didn't exactly happen. But in this game, Alex Bregman went 5-for-5. He had 2 home runs. He had a double and 2 singles, I believe 4 RBIs as well. So, and then he went and had the birth of his kid to attend the birth of his kid. So he did not play game three, but this was really, I think, a little bit of a get right game for them. And you know, you kind of saw them, their backs against the wall early on in the season. And to come out and make a statement from your newly acquired leader in the clubhouse, it seems like everybody gravitates towards Alex Bregman. And to go out there to produce a 5-for-5 game with 2 home runs and really putting the team on your back, I just thought that was awesome. And also, just real quick, Jaron Duran also hit his first home run of the season in this game, which I love to see.
Yeah, that was good to see, at least. I mean, I know it's a little league ballpark down there. It's built with the exact same dimensions as Yankee Stadium, and it's also the most wind-affected ballpark in the league, even more so than Yankee Stadium. So they're playing in a shoebox down there. Yeah. And ultimately, I think that aided a good bit of, like I said, in the 10 games since the St. Louis series, you've hit 6 home runs. I think that was a big reason for that. I mean, obviously we have the Hamilton solo shot in game three, Campbell hit one in game two, Campbell hit one in game one. Duran hit his first in game two, Bregman hit 2 in game two. So I think that was a big reason for that, but it was nice to see, like you said, like if Garrett Crochet is your stopper where you need to go out and not get swept by the fucking Chicago White Sox, you go out and you get blown the fuck out by the Tampa Bay Rays. We didn't even mention it. Alex Cora called out. He said the coaches felt like he called out everyone from top to bottom, saying that we weren't prepared enough for this one. We need to be more prepared. If Crochet's your stopper on the mounds, and then Alex Bregman is your stopper on offense, because he came out there and, like Crochet did a couple times now already, he slapped his nuts on the table. He goes 5-for-5, hits a couple Breggy bombs, and then goes and has a kid. So it was good to see him kind of come alive. The rest of the offense kind of went with him there, but obviously he was the catalyst for that. And then I guess that's all I really have in game two. And then obviously in game one, David Hamilton, who everyone was screaming to bunt, including myself, in that extra innings game in the Toronto series. I think it was the Tanner Houck game, so the middle game. And he hits one out. He hits a unicorn.
327 feet.
Only ballpark he gets out in, including Yankee Stadium. Talk about a shoebox. Cora said that he thought it was a double or a triple off the bat, and then somehow it got out. I mean, even Dave O'Brien was like, and this one's going to get down for extra bases. And he was like, wait a second, this one's out. Like, so, I mean, it was a little bit of a cheapie, but they don't ask how, and ultimately it gets the job done. You would have liked to see more than one run there in that game. But I mean, if you're winning a 1-0 ball game with Sean Newcomb on the mound, I guess that's, it's good business as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Yeah. Not much else to add there. I just will say that the bullpen looked really good this game. Greg Weissert came in a key spot. I think it was either two runners on or maybe just one runner on, but they took Sean Newcomb out.
Just one, Danny Jansen.
Okay, yeah. So, you know, a little bit of traffic. Sean Newcomb is the king of traffic. But he got out of it somehow this game. So Greg Weissert got a key out there, pitched another clean inning. And then both of our fanboys, Whitlock and Slayton, pitched clean innings to finish out this game. So, yeah, you love to see it. I think there's a little bit of momentum heading into this White Sox series, albeit a one-nothing game. I don't know how much momentum that gives you, but in terms of the pitching staff, that has to be a good sign for them. So did you have anything else before we preview White Sox series?
It just kind of feels like a miracle that you got out of this road trip 3-3. I mean, yeah. I gave all the stats earlier, but to have 10 games from that St. Louis series, six of them on the road, obviously, and, you lose a series to the Chicago White Sox, and it's hard to be like, okay, well, that's a positive, but you come out and you get outscored, whatever it was to, I mean, obviously with the blowout, it's going to be inflated, but to come out of here 3-3, 10-10, it feels like a minor miracle. And like you said, like, I don't know how much momentum you have going into the series against the White Sox, because you did just lose a series to them, but hopefully they can get things squared away. I know tomorrow is supposed to be like almost 80 degrees out, so maybe that kind of sparks the offense. Tonight it's going to be a little bit chillier, but even so, it's not going to be the 30 degrees that we saw in that Blue Jays series. Thank Hopefully God. They can come home Fenway Friday, get the momentum going a little bit, and really kind of take off from here. I know they welcome Seattle after Chicago, and their Seattle is not a very good offense either. So hopefully you can find a way to put together a little bit of a winning streak heading into Cleveland, Toronto. I mean, the schedule is pretty soft up until you play Texas at home May 6th, 7th, 8th, then welcome the Royals and the Tigers. So a bunch of playoff teams, or should be playoff teams, the Braves, the Mets. It really kind of picks up in the month of May. So hopefully they can get some easy wins here. Not easy wins, but well, you know what? No, it's the Chicago White Sox. These should be four easy wins. Hopefully you can pick those up and then kind of use that to springboard you into kind of the meat and potatoes of your schedule.
Yeah. Yeah. Talk your shit. I like that. Also, Christian Arcan last night was saying that he needs the Red Sox to absolutely bury the White Sox this weekend. So a little bit of a spark heading into this series, but we'll start with game one, which is tonight. I will be in attendance, boots on the ground. Thank God it is not 30 degrees again, because I saw Garrett Crochet's first start and I was freezing my ass off, so I'm happy to not have to do that again. This is a 7-10 start. It is Martin Perez. Still says TBD on MLB.com for the Red Sox, but I'm pretty sure it's going to be Hunter Dobbins.
Yeah.
So that's game one. I know Martin Perez he had a really mixed start against the Red Sox last time. I mean, I think he gave up four walks, but also struck out five.
4 2/3, 5 hits, 2 earns, 4 walks, 5 Ks.
Yeah. So I'm not going to lie. I'm a little bit worried, not of Martin Perez, but I'm a little bit worried about Alex Cora's lefty lineup coming out in this game, because I have a feeling, I don't think we've gotten the lineups out yet, but I have a feeling he's going to mess with things. And I know I've gotten into it before, but I just have one lineup consistently. I really don't care about lefty-righty matchups, because you end up tinkering with it so much as the game gets into the later stages anyway. But yeah, I'm pretty confident heading into this game. And Hunter Dobbins looked good in his first start.
Yeah, and I mean, we've seen Martin Perez. I believe tomorrow it's Shane Smith.
Yep.
Double check that. Yeah, so Shane Smith tomorrow, another guy you've already seen. On Sunday, that would mean that it's what?
Sean Burke? Yeah, I think it's Sean Burke.
Yeah, whatever the Burke guy is, and then Jonathan Cannon on Monday, who you didn't see. But you've now had a week to digest this film against three of these four Chicago White Sox starting pitchers. Mm. You should have found a way to piece something together, a better plan of attack, a better anything. Like, you need, in that hitters meeting that is probably going on right now at Fenway, they need to have a better plan of attack against some of these guys. I mean, the strikeouts are ridiculous, and I think I've made that abundantly clear in this episode. I mean, we cannot be striking out 29 times in three games against the Chicago White Sox pitching staff, which I know they have a bunch of Massachusetts legends on their roster, weirdly. But, like, these are guys that are on the Chicago White Sox. Like, the Can Man, Big Cannon, on Monday, on Marathon Monday, that should be a fucking 10-piece on Cannon.
Mm-hmm.
Team Perez, this is a guy, like we said, mixed bag in his start last week, only somehow escapes giving up two runs. It'd be more. Four walks and only getting two runs out of those four walks. It just needs to be, it needs to be more explosive against this team. And I'll concede that you can't lose the series, can't split the series. This has to be 3 out of 4 at the absolute worst.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you there. I don't want to predict the sweep just because I think they're going to have a rough outing in one of these games, probably the Tanner Houck game, because I'm just very, very low on him right now. But you got to take 3 out of 4 at least. I will not be happy with anything less.
Yeah, that would be a complete catastrophe. I just don't know. Like, I lean with you. The Tanner Houck game feels like the easy one to pick. We'll see what we get out of Walker Buehler. The swing and miss still hasn't really been there, but we kind of knew that was going to be the case going in. We heard him in the offseason on various different platforms and interviews saying that he learned a lot more pitchability with his stuff rather than just trying to blow guys away. So obviously that should factor in as the season goes on, and we've seen the whiff rate be not where it was. Also, we have some news here coming across the docket right now. Michael Fulmer DFA'd. I assume that's to make room for Hunter Dobbins on the he's already on the 40-man, obviously. But make room on the MLB roster for Hunter Dobbins. So Michael Fulmer DFA'd. I assume he's just going to clear waivers and head right back to AAA. Also, Alex Bregman back tonight. Nick Sogard back to Worcester. So Alex Bregman home run, lock of the night, dad strength, new bomb. I'll be taking that. Also, as I pull up Twitter from looking at the MLB trade rumors article, Marcelo Meyer hit a grand slam about an hour ago. So back-to-back games with a grand slam for the two legs of the big three that are still down in AAA Worcester. I know Meyer hasn't been great in AAA to start the year after a pretty hot start, and obviously the spring that he had, but good to see him take one out. It was a 108 exit velo, 400 feet pulled. So shout out Marcelo Meyer.
Yeah, shout out Marcelo Meyer. I'm not going to lie, I'm a little bit worried heading into this series, and that's not how I would like to be heading into a series with the Chicago White Sox. But this has the potential to be a big get-right series for them.
Yeah, it almost feels like it has to be in terms of the offense. Yeah. You got a 1-0 win. The offense was a little quiet, but even in that third game against the Rays, it just felt like they were hitting the ball hard. It just wasn't carrying the same way that it was in the other games. And like I said, the most wind-affected ballpark in baseball, that means blowing out and blowing in. I mean, even more so than Wrigley Field, which is crazy because I never would have guessed that there would be another park in the league that is more wind-affected than Wrigley. but I guess this isn't really a major league park, so it doesn't fully count, but wind was blowing in. It felt like there was a lot of hard contact. I think Casas specifically hit a ball that's center that he absolutely smoked. I mean, there were a lot of balls the first couple innings that off the bat, you're like, oh, okay, like that's hit hard the way the ball's carrying in this park, like that might get out. And then like a couple I actually stood up or like was like, oh, well, that one's gone. And then they didn't, they died. Got a little bit more used to it as the game wore on, but feels like they're starting to make some better contact, higher quality of contact. So hopefully we can see that play out out, especially with some warmer weather at Fenway this weekend, aside from Monday, which I know is going to be on the chillier side and rainy. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's the game where we don't see the offense explode. But I think tomorrow with Garrett Crochet on the mound in near 80-degree weather, that should be a game that you just go out there and blow the fucking doors off the Chicago White Sox. Like, Crochet's obviously, we just saw him face this lineup, and this is not Sean Burke and Martin Perez and Shane Smith and Jonathan Cannon. This is Garrett Crochet. I don't think the White Sox are going to make too many adjustments to not get no hit through 7 1/3 against Garrett Crochet in this one. So
yeah,
like, that's a game that you should just absolutely blow the doors off them in.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm cautiously optimistic heading into this series, but regardless, another week of baseball is always good. I hope next time that we talk, we won't be hitting the panic button after another series loss to the White Sox. But yeah, as always, thanks so much for listening, and we'll talk to you guys next time.